You have been stuck with seeing me Sunday after Sunday, while the far better one in our family stays back and hides or prays or, and I just, it's a fun day for me to get to share this morning with Leanne. Normally what we do is there is a scripture reading and we are going to divide that in kind of into two parts. So, it's going to be more dramatized, but Leanne is going to start and then come back a little bit later in the service. So it's my distinct honor to introduce Leanne to you. If you haven't met her yet, come on up.
Good morning. Happy Resurrection Sunday. And I have a reading for you. This is from the perspective of Mary Magdalene. It's called He Spoke by Simon Marshall. It was dark, utter darkness in the middle of the day, a darkness that didn't just surround you but crept into your soul and smothered it. Oh, I'd known dark times before, those days of possession. The days when I didn't know what I was doing, what I was saying, where I was going, who I was. But then that had changed. He spoke. At his word, the darkness lifted. A new life started where who I am was linked with who he is. For the first time, I knew that life had a purpose, a meaning. The Galilean countryside had never seemed so green, the lake never so blue. The meals we all shared, there was fun and seriousness, joy, laughter, and the food. Even bread tasted better, fresher. And He spoke. Words of power, authority. Not always easy words. Not always comforting words, but they burned in your heart and in your soul. And you knew, I knew, I would never be the same again. So we came to Jerusalem. You should have seen the crowds as people were singing for joy as he entered that city on the donkey. Hosanna! Blessed is the King of Israel! We knew this was big. We knew things were about to change. How could they not? We had heard him speak. We were changed. Jerusalem would hear him speak, and it would change. The world would change, right? There was no end to what we thought was about to happen. The next days went by in a blur of anticipation and excitement. And then the night fell. The soldiers came. And we watched, helpless, hopeless, as he was crucified. But we could do nothing. Where was Peter, Matthew? Where were they? Only John stayed nearby. And in all this pain and rejection and suffering, Jesus spoke. He spoke words of comfort to his mother, words of love, concern, as he hung there, dying. And then he died in the darkness. And as he died, he spoke, "It is finished." I know the sun came out later, but it was dark inside as Mary and I went with Joseph and Nicodemus to the tomb. We watched as they laid him on the shelf of rock, as they rolled the stone across the entrance, as the light went out. 3 days go by, 3 days of sorrow, anguish, and anger, 3 days of pain in a bottomless pit of despair. Days of fear and nights with no rest.
This morning, it's going to be a little bit different than Monday, Thursday, or Good Friday. Bruce, your Good Friday service was how long? 4 hours. We're not going to be here that long. Don't worry there, but we're going to make the most of our minutes. Is it just me, or is it a little bit hot in here? What? You don't like my shirt? I don't understand. Okay, here's why I did it. Because I wanted that exact reaction. Because something happens in our head when all of a sudden, here's what we expect, then there's a switch, and our minds change. It's like we have two different operating systems in our head at the very same time. The first is fast thinking. And that's how we go through most of our lives. We make very, very quick decisions. We evaluate things really, really quickly. And it gets us through. Maybe not so accurate, but it's how we get through. And then something happens and we shift over into slow thinking, when we have to really pay attention. Now, on any given day, you make between 25,000 and 35,000 decisions with your fast thinking mind. Do you know how many you make of slow thinking? 70. Just 70. Why? Well, part of it is that slow thinking is hard on our brains, and I could even give you an example of it. Let's say that I gave you the assignment of walking around the block outside, but you had to count backwards from 200 by sevens. I wouldn't send you out one by one. I'd have to send you out by two, because something almost invariably happens when you try doing that and walking at the same time. You need the other person to watch out for you, because what happens is that, well, thinking backwards in seven doesn't work for us. And so instead of walking, we slow down. And here's a really strange part. We kind of veer left. I don't know why, but that's part of the challenge of slow thinking. Well, Phil, what does all of this have to do with Easter? Well, as you can tell by the color of my hair or the lack of it, I have seen a lot of Easters over the years and a lot of Sundays before Lent. And almost all of the messages look at the events of Easter through one particular lens, through Mary Magdalene or the denial of Christ or the Last Supper. But one thing that I don't think that we've done a very good job of is to really understand what must have taken place over the last week, almost 10 days of Jesus's life. And what I want you to do today is put yourself in the place of the disciples. What were they expecting 10 days before the cross? And to help me out on that, I'm going to have a couple sets of people come up and be in the place of the disciples for what I want to show you. So let's see, who did I talk to? Hans, Loretta, and Tim. Come on up.
Since Danny's talk wasn't a surprise, this will be.
It better not be. So this is roughly the amount of time. But I want to start with something that, you know what, I had never really paid attention to that much before. I know that's a strange thing to admit, that after all of my years, you would think that I might know events of the Bible really well. But I want to introduce you to one that was pretty new to me. And what appears to have happened is that Jesus heals Lazarus. He resurrects Lazarus from the dead. And that triggered some sort of a public reaction from the authorities towards Jesus. And so Jesus and the disciples, they go hide out in a small town called Ephraim, about 13 miles from Jerusalem. Here it goes. Next slide. So from that time on, the Jewish leaders began to plot Jesus' death. As a result, Jesus stopped his public ministry among the people and left Jerusalem. He went to a place near the wilderness, to the village of Ephraim, and stayed there with his disciples. Jesus said, listen, we're going to go up to Jerusalem, where all the predictions of the prophets concerning the Son of Man will come. He will be handed over to the Romans, and he will be mocked and treated shamefully and spit upon. They will flog him with a whip and kill him, but on the third day he will rise again. But they didn't understand any of this. They failed to grasp what he was talking about. So what I want the three of you to do, and it doesn't have to be long or anything, but what do you think it must have been like to put yourselves there and to hear all of that for the first time? You know, we're talking about fast thinking and slow thinking. This becomes one of those slow thinking times. Put yourselves there. Be part of the disciples. And you hear him say that. What's going to go through your minds? Whoops. You don't have to do the talking. You can hand it off. What?
Or you can do it.
Confusion.
Yeah.
Frustration.
You're expecting Jesus is going to be everything. He's going to be the next leader of our country, of our people.
Disappointment and doubt.
Yeah. Anything else?
He's speaking metaphorically. It's not really, I mean, you know, he, you know, all of this is, you know, all this means something else, right? Like, they're really not going to kill him. They're not really going to, I mean, they might beat him. They might throw him in jail. And that's probably going to be the gist of it. But I think that he's trying to tell us something, trying to make us understand something beyond the words that he's actually speaking. Because okay. I really don't think that's going to happen.
Okay. Anything else, Loretta?
I mean, I just think I think I would have been used to being confused by things that Jesus said, because I feel that the many chapters and verses before this are all the disciples being like, say what? What?
Yeah.
What? And then he's like, oh, I'm going to explain. And then it's like, I still don't know. I don't know what you mean.
You can tell when your head is shifting from fast thinking to slow thinking, because almost involuntarily you go, what? And I think that's right. So let's go to the next one. So by this time, it's time for Passover. It's time to head to Jerusalem. And so everybody is walking along. And as they're walking along, this happens. Then the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Jesus with her sons. She knelt respectfully to ask a favor. What is your request? He asked. She replied, in your kingdom, please let my two sons sit in places of honor next to you, one on your right and the other on your left. But Jesus answered by saying to them, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink from the bitter cup of suffering I am about to drink? Oh, yes. We were able. And Jesus told them, you will indeed drink from my bitter cup, but I have no right to say who will sit on my right or my left. My Father has prepared those places for the ones he had chosen. What? Now, what made this even more difficult is that if we read on just a few verses, what happens is that the rest of the disciples get torqued because mom is doing an end around the rest of them. And these two boys who are supposed to be known as the sons of thunder, they have mom do it. So how does this hit you? If you're part of the other disciples and you're watching her try to do an end around because they want corner offices when Jesus moves into the White House, how does this hit you?
Bruhs, you had your mama come up here and ask me, man, what's wrong with you?
Where's my mom? And let me get her to start advocating for me.
I genuinely think I would have been feeling, oh, this is going to end like every other human endeavor. Okay. And we're going to start. Really? Really? That's where this is going right now?
Okay.
I knew that about, I suspected that about you. I saw that in you. And now my negative beliefs about you are being confirmed. I was right all the time. You were just vying.
Okay. Don't let your blood pressure get up too high there. But we are done. Let's go to the next one. Jesus entered Jericho and made his way through the town. There was a man there named Zacchaeus. He was the chief tax collector in the region, and he had become very rich. He tried to get a look at Jesus, but he was too short to see over the crowd. So he ran ahead, climbed a sycamore tree beside the road, for Jesus was going to pass that way. There were five tax regions inside Israel. This area around Jericho, this was the cash cow. Whoever got to be the, quote, tax farmer had become a very, very rich person. And here's how it worked. The Roman government had a set amount of money that they wanted to make from each region. To get to be the tax farmer is you had to guarantee that amount, pay off all sorts of bribes, and then once you got the certificate, then you got to turn around and charge people whatever you thought they could pay or would pay. The corruption here is unbelievable. So when you picture Zacchaeus, think of Vito Corleone, the Godfather, because that's exactly what he would have been like, a pinky ring on each little finger, three-piece robes. He wants to see what's going on, and so he climbs on the back of two of his Goombas up into a tree. That story is cute, and I'm sure it's true, but it's what comes next that would have devastated these three. When Jesus came by, he looked up at Zacchaeus and called him by name. Zacchaeus, he said, quick, come down. I must be a guest in your home today. What Jesus is doing is he is, in a sense, demanding table fellowship. What? Everybody would have known somebody who had lost their farm or lost their lands, who weren't able to eat because of this guy. And remember, he's not the tax farmer. He's the tax rancher. And for Jesus to ask, oh my goodness, for Jesus to ask for table fellowship or a meal with this person, it would make a good Jewish person like Jesus or the disciples ceremonially unclean. They'd have to go through a process of paying 10 bucks and becoming ritually pure again. And if it was found out that they had gone inside his house, it would mean ostracization. Because what the rabbi said about people like Zacchaeus is that they were no longer the sons of Abraham. And Jesus is demanding table fellowship, a meal with him. You're three good Jewish people. you've kept the rules your entire life. You know stories about this guy. Now, what goes through your mind?
I'm going to give the Gen Z response.
Oh, this is going to be good.
Embarrassing.
Okay. That's fair.
I mean, I think I would have that feeling of like, you know, I mean, I don't feel like this happens to me that much, but I am managed. But, you know, like I'm doing something that is embarrassing to somebody else. And I think, you know, they think I don't know that this is not appropriate or, you know, I shouldn't be doing that. And so, like, I would feel like, oh, Jesus, you clearly don't know what's going on here, even though, you know, I'm following you around and you're the Messiah. But clearly you are missing something because you don't know everything about this guy that you need to know, because you would never do this. And it would just be totally breaking my like internal, like, oh my gosh, we cannot, right? We cannot. I would really want to manage Jesus and what he's saying to make it more conform with what felt better.
Yeah, I think that there might also be this, why does he keep doing this? He keeps associating us with people that we shouldn't be associating with. We should actually be, you know, castigating those folks for what they're doing, especially this guy. You know, why would you associate us with this guy? Like, we're supposed to be separate from them, and you keep bringing in these people that make us question, what are we doing?
Okay. Are you beginning to get the feel here of what happens? It's slow thinking upon slow thinking upon slow thinking. And what happens with slow thinking over time, if the thoughts are really, really challenging, it leads to disorientation, which leads to anxiety, which leads to fear, which begins to explain the behaviors that we're going to see in the disciples. Next scene. They've got a Sabbath day. So they rest before they go the 18 miles up to Jerusalem, 7 days out. So they have gone up to Bethany, and they've been invited to a meal in an evening. When a certain immoral woman from that city heard that he was eating there, she brought a beautiful alabaster jar filled with expensive perfume, 300 denarii, a year's salary, so about $35,000. Understand the dollars that we're talking about. Then she knelt behind him at his feet, weeping. Her tears fell on his feet, and she wiped them off with her hair. Then she kept kissing his feet and putting perfume on them. This is where you need to step into the world of Jesus. I'm not going to become indelicate, but you need to understand that the only person that would have that kind of money tied up in perfume, you would understand her vocation. What makes this situation even more difficult is that to wipe his feet with her hair, she has to unpin her hair. And a Jewish man was never to see the hair let down of a woman that was not his wife. So this is a scene that would make everybody uncomfortable. She breaks off the top of her perfume. She pours it all out $35,000 worth of perfume in a 10 by 20 foot room. Can you get a feel of that? I tried to do a facsimile of this one time for my church in Oak Grove, and I went to Walmart. Bad first move. And I got like a thing of perfume that a 12-year-old boy would get for a mother that he loves for Christmas, you know, where it's like a whole quart of perfume. And I put in little pie tins around the room when people came in. I had perfume just sitting out there. I thought I was going to have a church split on my hands that morning because people walked in and just said, oh, this is terrible. Well, imagine that. This is a scene that feels very, very morally shaky. And now all of that perfume is pooling on the floor. our olfactory senses, they're probably some of our most powerful senses that we have. The disciples are looking on, and Jesus's critics, and they're all complaining, hey, that money could be used for other great things besides this. Now, she's probably come because maybe she had heard about Lazarus dying and doesn't know that he had been resurrected. And so she wants to anoint his body. I take it as a desire to leave her former career. But you're sitting there, what's going through your mind? I mean, there are pools of lots of perfume on the floor. You're good rule-keeping Jews. What? How does this hit you?
I mean, I like to hope, or whatever my 2024 like lens, like as a woman, that I would not have the same kind of real judgment of her. I'm that, you know, women throughout history and even today find themselves in very difficult situations. And so I would hope I would have compassion for her and appreciate the sort of beautiful sacrifice that she has made for Jesus, being that it wouldn't be scandalous to me because I will have seen many women's hair down, although not my own.
Yeah. But you don't know for sure that Jesus is going to be dying. You don't really know at this point yet what any anointing would be for.
Right.
Yeah. Anything else, guys? You don't have to say anything.
I don't have to say that thing.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out how many more of these do we have.
This is your last one.
This is the last one?
Yeah.
Okay. No. No. I think I'm maybe getting close to, I've been sort of disassociated from this whole thing. Like, I can't believe that this is the train. It feels like the train is leaving the station. I'm in disbelief. And maybe right now I'm starting to understand that something is happening that I can't stop.
Yeah.
Maybe. Or I'm still totally
okay.
In disbelief.
I also think too that this is another example it would be for them that they can't separate the old from what Jesus is doing new for them, right? They're so hung up on the old religion, the old traditions, that seeing this is not telling them, oh, he's doing something new. It's more still consumed with, oh, this is a sacrilege. You know, how dare this unclean woman touch him? And it won't be until after his death and resurrection that they actually get, oh, he was actually doing something new. And we were so caught up.
So in the moment, they're just going, what?
Right.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I want to have our students come on up to take your places. Appreciate it. Very good job. Yeah, come on up. Anybody else want to be a student for the day? Oh, good. Good, good, good. You. No, I'll put you with them. So, you're beginning to get that they are having to do some hard, slow thinking, and it's just piling up on them, right? Next scene. But as he came closer to Jerusalem and saw the city ahead, well, before we go there, we need to back up and understand the situation. This is Passover, small little Jerusalem, 50, 75,000 people, explodes to somewhere near 500,000. And across from the Temple Mount on the Mount of Olives, it looks like a Woodstock camp out. probably 50, 75, 100,000 people camped out. They've come from a long way away. A lot of the people come from the Galilee. They already like Jesus. And somehow they hear that there's going to be a parade, an inaugural parade for Jesus. They see him on a donkey, and they're thinking, because a Messiah riding on a donkey was an indication of the king. And so this is like the start of what you've been hoping for all along. You know, all that other stuff that you've just heard, this is it. You know, people are pulling out their iPhones and high-fiving each other, and it looks great. The crowds are coming, and they're singing, Hosanna, Hosanna, and it is marvelous. You're thrilled. You guys don't look thrilled. Look thrilled. But the donkey comes all the way down to the bottom of the hill. Jesus climbs off the donkey and he begins to weep. Some of the translations have that he begins to wail. There's a difference between weeping and wailing. Okay, you get it? I don't have your ability. My wailing doesn't get there. I know. He goes, how I wish today that you of all people would understand the way to peace, but now it's too late and peace is hidden from your eyes before long. Your enemies will build ramparts against your walls and encircle you and close in on you from every side. They will crush you into the ground and your children with you. Your enemies will not leave a single stone in place because you did not recognize it when God visited you. Okay, this day that started out to be so incredible has just ended this way. How do you feel, guys? Because you are closer to the age of the disciples than a lot of the other people in the room. Yeah.
I'd feel pretty depressed.
Why?
Because the day is supposed to be really good and it just ended with this.
You're sitting there. This temple is going to be done in just a couple of years. It's nearly one of the wonders of the world. And he's saying, it's all going to kind of come apart.
I'd be confused. And I'm kind of confused right now, too. Like, but... Yeah, I feel like I'd be like, I don't know, startled, confused about what's happening. Yeah.
Anything else?
It's really happening right now. Curious and a little bit wondering, like, what happened to this guy?
Yeah, has he gone off the rails?
Yeah.
Has he lost his... He had the chance right here in front of us to inaugurate everything. He's got... thousands of people who are behind him and ready to go. And he's saying, no, I don't want to get on that conveyor belt. Okay. Next 4 days. Now, what we're doing is we're speeding up because I'm quickly running out of time here. But we could have talked about when Jesus clears the temple. I mean, here's dear, sweet, kind Jesus. All of a sudden, he's throwing tables and sheep and birds and he finishes and he just walks out. But this is Passover. This is the Lord's Supper. And during a Passover meal, there are two times to wash your hands. This is probably the second one. So he got up from the table, took off his robe, wrapped a towel around his waist and poured water into his basin. Then he began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with the towel he had around him. That by itself would be another slow thinking moment because here's the thing. Everybody had already washed really, really well before you ever came to a Passover. And the other thing is that any washing would have been done at the start of the meal, any last washing. But there was an unspoken rule that no Jew should ever have to wash the feet of another Jew. Even if they're a servant, even if they're a slave, that's the one thing they didn't have to do. Yet Jesus does that. And so no wonder that Peter says, what? You're not going to wash my feet, because it's not just humiliating for Jesus. It's humiliating for him to have a master, a rabbi who is doing that. How would you feel about that, guys?
I'd feel very surprised, but I'd feel thankful though. I'd feel thankful. I'd be like, thank you. But also not thank you.
I think I got that. Anything else? You don't have to.
No, I do want to share. I think I'd be, yeah, I'd also like, I connect with Luke on that. Cause I mean, it's like the Messiah wants to wash your feet. So like, I mean, that's like a really cool opportunity.
But you do know, you did hear that he said that you would then have to turn around and do the same thing.
Oh, well, yeah.
For other people.
I'd willingly. Oh, for other people?
Yeah. Whoa.
I'd still be down, honestly.
Okay. Like, all right. All right. That's good. Okay. We're going to keep going here. Let me finish that last paragraph. Okay. And as they were at the table eating, Jesus said, I tell you the truth, one of you eating with me will betray me. Greatly sorrowing, each one asked in turn, am I the one? Am I the one? Is one of the 12 who is eating from this bowl with me, probably reaching in for the horseradish with Judas at the same time. For the Son of Man must die as the scriptures declared long ago, but how terrible it will be for the one who betrays him. It would be far better for that man if he had never been born. And everybody's eyes go to the dish of horseradish. And there's Judas reaching in at the very same time. You've been able to be kind of quieter here. How would that hit you, Alex? I mean, here is somebody that you've just spent 3 years with.
Yeah. Honestly, my first reaction might be like, am I betraying him? Am I gonna, did I, mm-hmm. You know, I think honestly, I would have, I don't know if this is on. Right. I think honestly, I would have a bit of a mix between, concern about what has happened, but then also concern with this guy that I've been following for a while. Like, I'm not.
Is it all unraveling?
Sure, uh-huh. Who to be trusting in this moment?
Yeah. Okay, time is going fast. Let's go to one more. And even as Jesus said this, Judas, one of the 12 disciples, arrived with a crowd of men armed with swords and clubs. They had been sent by the leading priests and elders of the people. The traitor Judas had given them a prearranged signal. You will know which one to arrest when I greet him with a kiss. Then Simon Peter drew a sword, slashed off the right ear of Malchus, the high priest's slave. But Jesus said to Peter, put your sword back into its sheath. I shall not drink from the cup of suffering the Father has given me. So you have just watched as Peter, he is overwhelmed now by 10 days of slow thinking. And where does he get a knife? Well, it's probably the same knife that he uses to gut fish. He pulls it out and slices off the ear of Barney Fife. And you're watching all of this and you're going, what is going on here? And you see Jesus carted off. Got to tell you, all of a sudden, it makes sense why Peter denies Christ, doesn't it? Because he's had the last 10 days of shock after shock after shock after shock after shock. I get why the disciples are all gone and only John is there at the cross. What I don't get is why the women are there and the disciples aren't. Leanne, thank you guys. Please come up. Thank you very much.
Three days of fear and nights, no rest. Then the first day of the week, and it's so dark. Early, I find myself on the path in the garden, walking to the tomb. Why? Well, where else would I be? In the slowly breaking dawn, I see the tomb, but there's something wrong. Stone is gone. I know it's the right tomb, but something dreadful must have happened. I run to Peter, to the others. Two of them run off to the tomb. They leave me behind. I can scarcely move for fear and confusion. Later I get there. Peter says the tomb's empty. The burial cloth just lying there. What's that supposed to mean? And then they walk away. They leave the tomb. They leave me. And they go. What am I going to do? What happened? In that moment, in the dark night of my soul, I wept. My heart broke and I could do nothing else. I wept for lost hope. For him, for me, never had I felt so alone. And then I looked up. Something made me go over to the tomb. Trembling, I looked inside and there were two men. Where'd they come from? They asked me why I was crying. Why was I crying? Because my Lord has gone. I don't know where he is. That's why I'm crying. The Lord is gone. Turned, and there was another man. Gardener, I thought. Perhaps he had moved Jesus' body. So I asked him. And then he spoke. Never has one word meant so much. His voice of love and comfort, of majesty and power. He spoke. Mary. For the first time, my name seemed to mean something, something beyond ordinary. Mary. And the sun rose. It rose in glorious red, yellow, orange. It rose in my heart and banished the darkness. It flooded my soul with brilliant white light that felt so real, so heavy, could almost touch it. This was Jesus, not dead. Oh, no, not by any means, more alive than I'd ever seen him before. Jesus, alive, my Lord, returned. He spoke, and I wanted to sing. I wanted to shout for joy and wonder. The sheer thrill of the moment took my breath away. And so I speak. I shout, Jesus is alive. I have seen the Lord.
So I want to wrap up with kind of where I ended. So let's go to the next slide. And many women who had come from Galilee, isn't it interesting? It doesn't say just a few, it says many. And many women who had come from Galilee with Jesus to care for him were watching from a distance. And among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of James and John, the sons of Zebedee. And when Jesus saw his mother standing there beside the disciple he loved, he said to her, "Dear woman, here is your son." And he said to his disciple, "Here is your mother." And from then on, this disciple took her into his home. So I've just been reflecting the last couple months of going, why were the women courageous and there at the cross and the disciples weren't? Well, part of it is the cascading slow thinking of the last 10 days. But I think my friends, the women had been there for each of those events too. I've already explained how I think that the women would have been there for the Last Supper. I think that the women would have seen virtually everything that the guys have seen. Why did the men run and the women didn't? Well, might be because women, you're just tougher and more courageous than guys are. And I'd be the first one to say that I would agree to that. My wife is a very strong, gracious person. But I think it goes a little bit deeper than that even. When you look at the disciples, what you're seeing is that they're all trying to hold on to something. They're kind of looking at their life as consumers. You know, I want power. I don't want to lose too much. I want some sort of position in the future. And when you look at the women, almost every one of them had already lost something. Their hands weren't clutching. Their hands were open. The person who I think is at the very forefront of that is Mary Magdalene. And I know that Dan Brown and others have tried to turn her into a romantic girlfriend or spouse of Jesus. They also have tried to make her out to be a highly immoral woman. Strange thing with all of that is that Mary Magdalene is not seen as an immoral woman until a priest in the 5th century connected her with a woman who had broken the bottle of perfume. There's no reason to connect those at all. All we're told about her is that she had been freed from a possession of dark forces. The other thing, strangely, is that we know where she's from. Mary of Magdala. And that just kind of rolls off the tongue, right? Well, Magdala is a town about 10 miles north of Jerusalem, right on the Sea of Galilee. It was fish town. It was the town famous for rendering and fermenting fish that was turned into a popular condiment called garum. It was fish ketchup. Can you imagine how that town would smell? Mary comes from there. Now, do you call someone Mary of Magdala? Do you think of her as a romantic person if she always has that nickname? It'd be like saying Marge from Bakersfield, and that's how she's known all the time. Mary of Magdala. The other thing, strangely, when the women are listed, Mary Magdalene is always listed first. The Jewish social convention behind that is that that's usually the oldest person. So we tend to think of Mary Magdalene as someone beautiful, a starlet who is 20, 25 years old. Well, if Mary, the mother of Jesus, is 48, 49, 50, Mary Magdalene could very easily be 52, 53, 55. She's worked in a fish cannery through a lot of her life. She's the one that gets to tell the story of the risen Lord. And I find that so, it just blesses my heart to know that she would be the one given that great permission, that great opportunity. How does all of this connect with us? Well, let's try this on. When I look at the disciples and they are slow thinking, they are trying to hold on to Jesus while still being consumers. But I don't think that you can be a consumer and a disciple of Jesus at the same time. They are mutually exclusive. That to follow Jesus well, to get to experience all of what he has for us, means that we stop clutching and we open our hands and we say, I will take what you provide. Helen Keller said this, life is either a daring adventure or nothing at all. And that's what I'd want to leave you with this Easter is that when we look at religion in our society, a lot of it is still about clutching, but Jesus calls us to open our hands and to trust and to be like Mary of Magdala and follow, even though we don't know what the future is always going to look like. Life is a daring adventure or nothing at all. That's how you become an Easter person. See?